woke up this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
You talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Well, and Orbe Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howe. Ricky on the board. S&P futures down 275. NASDAQ futures up 175. So not much going on today so far. They're down a little bit more. Actually, the NASDAQ is down 15 and the S&P is down 6 when you get the current stuff up, because CNBC seems a little bit behind here. Imagine that. They're 10 minutes behind. They're 10 minutes behind on their site. They're live on the TV. They got some kind of a dispensation, as they used to use the church word. They go live on TV, but they're still 10 minutes behind on their site. So there. So I have to use my feed for PTI Securities, and that's always up to speed. We have Professor Carl.
Oh, you do. And I've got my console open because, you know, it's what I do before...
You're trading spoons.
I come on the show.
Trading
I'm not trading them right now, but I'm kind of looking at this. It looks kind of like a bridge with a bunch of potholes in it from overnight.
Maybe forming some kind of a blow off top. There seems to be a few things here I don't understand. A few things I'm starting to understand as we enter the new world. How many people in the country even know what the term plutocracy means? You think?
No, probably not all that many, but I'll tell you what, there was a column I happened to glance at yesterday, and I don't recall. I mean, I have this fire hose that comes at me of stuff that's in my my automated feed, and it tries to sift it some, which otherwise it would be completely unmanageable. But one of the there's some guy who apparently has done an awful lot of analysis on various blow-offs and the aftermath of them over time, and I always find some of those pieces interesting because so few people.
First of all, they're all different.
Well, yes, which is is where I was going. Is that okay? So all these people have. Not only are they all different, they're different, but they're the same. They're different in that the focus is in a different place.
Right.
Okay. But they're all the same in that it all comes down to the same basic thing, which is that you have the tendency of government officials and private industry both to pile into whatever appears to be playing the good side of the inflation curve, if you will. So I've talked about that a lot on the show and elsewhere, where when you start doing it, when you start an inflationary policy and you have a low level of debt when you do it, it looks like you're getting a free lunch because your output goes up faster than your debt service does at the beginning. And the problem with all exponential curves is that that's an illusion. It is at that instant true, however, it is not going to stay that way. And if you continue that policy, which of course you have to, because otherwise people howl that the next year doesn't have the 20% gain, right? If you continue that policy, the carrying costs of that additional leverage will eventually surpass the output that it can produce. And at that point, you've got a huge problem for what should be obvious reasons. And the fallback always comes from there. And what I think is amusing is that this particular individual said that what he expects is a blow off in the S&P to about 8,000 and then a 29 level crash. Okay. And my take on this is that, boy oh boy, you know, you want to talk about trying to play both sides of the game here, where essentially you're trying to suck people in for that last spike high.
I would say, right? As a trader, that sort of mentality, I don't...
That gets you killed.
Gets you killed. I mean, what you're saying is, not only am I smart enough to know a crash is coming, which maybe a lot of people might think a correction is coming, but I know I'm good enough to feed the up and know just when the down is going to turn. Boy, that's like having your cake and eating it too, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's what I've pointed out to a lot of people is that after the fact, everybody, there's always someone who manages to call the corner, right? Both at the top and the bottom.
Sure, you do 100 trades a day. You're gonna do one that lands right.
Well, yeah, and
you're gonna forget the other 99 and tell people how you sold the top.
Well, and there's you know, 10,000 people out there making these calls every day, right? And one of them is going to be correct for any particular inflection point.
Who's the lady who claimed she called the top in Gazzarelli? Was that her name? 87?
Yeah. Yeah, I think
I don't think
her.
She ever did, but did she? I don't know if she did or didn't. And the one in 2007, wasn't it the wrestler was on the show a couple of times. That was his name. They live in Bermuda, the blonde lady. And then they made another call later and pissed somebody off at CNBC or something and never went back on TV. What the hell is her name? I'll think of the wrestler's name. And she was his wife.
The thing is that, you know, what I look at here is that what I see is the pattern. You know, when I sold MCS, it was in the middle of the crazy, you know, with the NASDAQ run up during the, you know, the lead up to 2000, and it was the transaction closed in September of 98, and then I had a contractual obligation to hang around for the transition until the end of the year, so I had a 3-month term, okay, essentially. And the funny part was that the acquiring company was Winstar, and they listened to exactly none of my advice during that period.
Oh, no.
Absolutely none of it. Okay, I mean, for all intents and purposes, I was warming a chair for 3 months in the corner office. And, you know, and I just sat there, shook my head, and I'm like, you know, if I told them, you know, before they bought the place, because it was, you know, part of the pitch, was here is how you can leverage what I've done here into, you know, with a larger amount of capital, which they obviously had, and, you know, and turn it into something with much more impact on a, you know, on a basis to your, you know, your firm's balance sheet. I mean, that's the whole reason you buy somebody, supposedly, right?
Yeah, well,
you know, so they listened to exactly none of the advice. And then, of course, you know, a couple of years later, in the crash, they blew up like everybody else. And it was just fascinating to watch this, because every one of the people that I knew in the industry at the time is like, oh, you know, you're sure taking the company public. You'd have $1 billion. You'd be flying around in a, you know, an Cessna Citation, you know, yada, 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 yada. And I said, yeah, you know, you might absolutely be right. You might be right. I said, but the problem is that I look at this pattern and I do not know when it's going to end, but I know that it's going to. And if I'm a day late on it, I'm screwed.
Well, I mean, a lot of
and
stuff
I could be handing out. Well, and I could be handing out carts at Walmart for the next 30 years. You know, so.
Well, a lot of stuff that you rail on, that Hal surely rails on. I mean, it, you know, Hal's looking for the universal solution. Well, that's not happening. The thing that has, you know, busted my ass in the whole day, and a lot of it is just, I'll use the term being mature. As I used to think, and I still have these arguments with my brother, who is our spectacular president of PTI Securities, and the best brother that ever walked. That doesn't mean you don't argue constantly, right? He's absolutely convinced that people are genuinely decent-minded, especially even in government, and that when they make mistakes, they're people trying to do the right thing and basically bleep it up. And
I'd argue with him about that.
Yeah, well, I'm saying in some areas he's probably right, but in the other areas, every time I've seen something happen and some policy rise up to deal with it, it seems like the same people end up holding the bag and the other people end up holding the cash. And it, to me, it's not random after the fourth or fifth time.
Right.
It just isn't. And there was a letter to Quora. I didn't want to send it to you guys because it would inflame everybody who loves the administration. But we're talking about a government for the money class, like we've never seen before. But it's happened in history before, that they're going to control every piece of the media, every piece of everything. They're going to control the education process. It's exactly what they want.
Chief, but this has been going on for an awful long time.
Okay, but you can say that.
I'm not saying that. I was literally censored and threatened with being thrown in a concentration camp for the last 5 years. So I'm a little tired of people saying, "Well, Trump is evil, and all these other guys are good."
I didn't say that. What I said was, we've reached the point now where it's so obvious that people. I mean, you didn't have people 40 years ago. If they didn't like what they were saying, buying the Tribune. Now you do.
Well, okay, that's true. But the funny thing is that everybody loves to rant about this whole thing with Kimmel, right? But the reality, the fact is that the format's dying, and so you have, and it's not because the left or because the right or because the Trump or because the Biden or the Harris or they're Obama or whatever. It's because the people who used to watch late night TV were people like me, but 30 years ago.
Okay? I get it.
And so when you've got a guy that has 120,000 people across the entire nation watching his show, that's all right? And by the way, that's what the data says, all right? And the bad news is that's like a 75% decrease over the last couple of years. And he gets $16 million a year to sit in the chair. Okay, the math doesn't work on that. Now, the problem is he's got plenty of money, but he's also so arrogant he thinks he's still worth the $16 million.
Carl,
well, the world has changed.
I could give you the exact same story in Chicago radio. It would take me 20 minutes. But it gets to the point. That part is, that's competition. That's reality.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, but in my lifetime, I've never seen an FCC chairman come on TV and say, by the way, if you get a license from the government, you basically gave up your First Amendment right.
Actually, then you have not been paying attention, because the FCC has said that through. It's not just the FCC saying it, it's actually in the statute.
Everybody who, and David Faber asked him, does that mean if somebody goes on national TV, they have to have a script that's approved by you? Which is a pretty interesting question, actually. And
That is an interesting. I'm surprised Faber asked that, but yeah.
And the guy said something about, well, we're not there yet, or something.
Well, that's. Here's the thing.
Carl, here's the issue I have with basically a lot of the people on the show. It's not what's there in the writing. It's not what's there, what somebody could have done, or what somebody could have done would have. I know how hard it is for radio station. I mean, I know a lot about radio, unfortunately, and I know what has to happen for somebody to go from a 1,000-watt station where you can't compete with anybody to like 5,000 when you can. Even if the stations you're protecting are maybe long gone, it's a huge procedure. Yet some people seem to be able to work through this and do it. I mean, as an investor, it really doesn't do me any good to argue all this crap, because I'm not getting anywhere. And neither are you, and neither is Hal, and neither is Kevin, and neither is anybody.
Right.
We're not getting anywhere.
Right.
But now, the interesting part was the only guy who had it figured out on this Oracle, and I kept saying, careful when you start shorting something that just looks like it's so damn high. Maybe there's something behind it. And Wayne said, wait a minute. Ellison's kid and Trump's kid are like two bumps in the night, and whatever happened, and Oracle's gonna end up smelling like a rose somehow. Now all of a sudden they're gonna be X, right?
Well, they're now all of a sudden, yeah, all of a sudden they're TikTok.
Well, TikTok,
and, yeah. And I'm like, and you know, I mean, I that one. Well, and then here's the other thing, okay? Yesterday, this big spike in NVIDIA, okay, comes from yet more inside baseball and self-dealing with them, with the deal they just did with XAI.
Yeah.
Or OpenAI.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, if you want to talk about something that if we had a regulatory and an antitrust department that actually had a...
With this administration going back to Ronald Reagan, how could we ever have one?
We haven't had one.
Yeah, well, how could we ever have one?
Well, I get that, all right? But, I mean, that infuriated me more than anything. And by the way, that one was actually apparently kept quiet because I didn't see, you know, the huge move in front of it, right? Which is usually what happens. So I was shocked that, you know, hey, it's actually during the trading day that, you know, that the news hits and so does the big spike.
Right, now, of course,
if you were short these guys, you got it in the butt.
I keep trying to, and I'm not going to get anywhere with this because I'm trying and I'm getting nowhere. Somewhere along the line, even though stuff has always happened.
Yeah.
I mean, in Chicago, you knew... When I was growing up, it was always a little something. You know, you wet your beak. If you knew somebody, you got the job. If you were going to be a precinct captain for a while, you got some crummy job. You didn't get to be mayor, or you didn't get, maybe you got a job, you know, sweeping at the park district or something because you needed it. It was a job many people really didn't want, but it was okay. You know, and prices were low. You could actually get along with that. It's one thing to have that, but there also was a limit. Where people had this kind of view, okay, that's okay, but no. You don't become a precinct captain and become like superintendent of the schools. That's like too much. You know, there was some moral filter there someplace. Now, where you could define it or something, but most people, I'm going to say, what would Archie Barker used to say, real guys? Most people have some kind of an idea, well, that's all right. Or, no, that's a little too much. And the part that I'm having problems because a lot of people on the show are so goddamn political. Somewhere along the line, you can have somebody essentially taking a bag of stuff and giving Trump and the family something and getting a deal. And somebody on the show will say, oh, God, Lyndon Johnson took a bag of cash. The difference to me is the reason why Lyndon Johnson took a bag of cash is because he knew it was wrong, he knew it was immoral, and he hid it. He did it anyway. Yeah. He was an immoral man. That's a lot different to me than walking in the front door of Mar-a-Lago with essentially a bag and handing it to the guy, and everybody saying, that's okay, it's been happening forever. No, it hasn't. Not in that manner.
You're not going to get an argument from me on that one.
I mean, because we've gone from immoral to amoral, which to me is a huge difference.
Well, yes, but I simply point out that you know, everything is a continuum.
Without a doubt.
None of it happened in a vacuum. The crap that I saw going on when I was running MCS and the number of people who tried to shove it in my back door, and if I had the opportunity, I rammed them with it. And if not, you tried to get the hell out of the way so you didn't end up getting killed. But that's business, and it always has been. And the thing is, the reason we have a set of laws that say you're not supposed to be able to do certain things is because otherwise this ends up devolving into pistols at 20 paces out in the middle of the road, okay? And it used to, right? I mean, if you pissed people off sufficiently in the Old West, you were likely to find yourself on the wrong end of a duel, and I hope you were good at shooting because at least one of you was going to end up dead, maybe both. So, I mean, that was, we try to claim we're a more civilized and better society today. We're not.
I think we're going absolutely the opposite direction.
Absolutely. And you look at what just this proclamation that just came out that supposedly Tylenol is the cause of, you know, of all the autism. Jesus. You know what has it? The first rule, and Chief, you know this, because we do, you know, you've been around long enough and sold out.
Who makes talent? They obviously didn't bring the bag.
Well, but and here's the other thing. It's not just that. It's a, it's a generic. So how many you can go into a Kroger or a Walmart or whatever and get their version of it that doesn't have the label Tylenol on it.
The president can't pronounce it though. He tried about 8 times yesterday.
Well, I know he's
Well, I mean it's not an easy one to pronounce, so I'm not gonna. But I'm just curious. What do you suppose? You're a guy who likes to do some research. Now, he used to be on the show, and his company won't let him on anymore. He got a new place. Nobody lets anybody on the show anymore, which to me is a real problem. Nobody can talk. Talk about the censorship. The censorship is coming from companies.
Oh, absolutely.
So anyway, he is an adult. I don't know. I've known the guy so long. I'm gonna say 25-year-old autistic kid, nonverbal.
Yeah.
I mean, real bad shape. And
nice
kid. He's not violent, not anything. He's now living in a place where he's with other people. He's real happy. He comes to dinner 2 nights a week. They go there on a Saturday, whatever. But they've taken care of him dramatically. And what's the good news, there is such a piece of good news on that, is the rest of the family got so used to taking care of him that they take care of other people too. It's now in their DNA. If somebody's in a problem, their kids take care of people, older people and stuff, and a lot of people's kids don't. I mean, so there's been a positive. But now, do we think that somebody went and interviewed his wife and said, by the way, 25 years ago when you were pregnant, were you taking Tylenol? How do you come out of this one out of the blue? I mean, I'm not saying they're wrong, actually, because something probably is causing the... But how do you even start the research? By the way, you were pregnant with this kid 8 years ago. What were you doing? Were you eating bananas? Were you eating? How do you even start that research?
Well, here's the problem: is that when it comes to autism in particular, when it comes to any kind of condition that hits kids, all right? Because obviously an infant can't tell you what's going on in their head, right?
Well, they try their best.
Well, they scream, but that's all you got.
Yeah. Right?
You don't have a why.
No.
It's the same thing with a pet. Your dog can tell that the dog or the cat is in trouble, but you don't know why, right? Because they can't tell you where it hurts, just that it does. But there's two different aspects of this. And what Trump was talking about yesterday could only plausibly apply to one of them. All right. And this goes back to what I was saying about correlation and which we got sidetracked. So the first rule of any hypothesis is that if you have a correlation, you may or may not have found a cause. However, if the correlation's missing, you absolutely have it wrong. That's an absolute in any kind of scientific inquiry. And there's two different sets of autistic situations that arise. One is the kid that is obviously hosed at the time of birth.
That's what this kid was.
I'm just saying, they never progressed normally.
They knew he was messed up before he had inoculation one, so they never blamed it on the shot.
Well, I'm just saying, there's those babies who immediately there is a problem, because within the first month or two, the normal things that a baby does, this kid does not do. Okay, and as time goes on, those things that normally happen don't. Right? Yep. And so that's there. That was present at the time of birth, whatever the situation was. But the second one, and the one that no one is chasing, is what some people call, and is probably properly labeled, refractory autism, where you have a kid that is developing normally. They all of a sudden, supposedly out of the middle of nowhere, they were verbal and now they're not, were pre-verbal and now they're not. Okay, out of the middle of nowhere, at age two or whatever, that happens, and that is environmental. That is absolutely environmental, and that is the one that gets me, because that's where the largest increase in these circumstances has come from historically.
Do you think it could potentially be, I was talking to somebody last night who was thinking It's potentially genetic and something triggers it?
Well, so the problem with the
I'm not just talking about autism. I'm talking about a lot of this stuff. I mean, do we
no,
don't know?
I understand that. The problem with the genetic explanation is that genetic changes in a population don't happen in the space of 30 or 40 years, and this has. Okay, they happened in the space of 1,000 years. All right, it's just the way recombination. I mean, your only crack at a genetic change happens once in a generation, right? When you're conceived.
Well, some people, actually, some I'll say races of people have a serious problem in diffusing alcohol. Well, how did anybody know they had it until somebody gave them a shot of booze?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's things like that, okay, but there is the possibility that this is biphasic. There's been a lot of discussion over the years, and I did a lot of research into this because I had a nephew who got leukemia. We thought he'd beaten it, and it came back and killed him when he was a young adult, okay. And there are quite a few people that believe that leukemia is in fact a biphasic disease. There's a genetic component to it and a viral infective component. They both have to be there for you to actually get leukemia. And this is why, while most kids who are going to get it when they're children, once in a while you get somebody that doesn't get that second element of the exposure until they're, you know, 14 or 15, right? And that's why it gets triggered at that point in time. Now, the problem is we haven't identified either the genetic mutation or the infectious agent.
Yeah, well,
well, that's a problem.
And maybe won't for like a long time.
Yeah, I mean, but this is, you know, there's that side of the theory behind it. I mean, it was...
Well, some of that has happened. We had a Katie Ann, and she was working on the... matter of fact, she gave a presentation at Stanford and Harvard. Terrific young lady, and they found her research team had found the genetic marker for one of these orphan diseases, and they haven't come close to a cure, but they at least have found the genetic marker. And but it's one of these diseases, you know, the 200 people a year get, or 500 or something. What's the max you can have and still be called an orphan disease? 1,000 people or 500 or something?
I don't know what it is. It's a low number, though.
It's a low number.
Yeah,
I know. Then Eric Parsegian, the coach of Notre Dame, his family, he had like three or four of his grandkids die or something, and it's still the foundation for that particular disease. I don't know if they're making any progress or not, but I mean, that's tough to get. But let's get back to we're down this road that people aren't even ashamed of admitting what they're doing, and I've never seen this, and you're probably right. It's somewhere. I mean, you read it. You are right. Somewhere buried in the FCC charter in the license agreement, there's something in there that you can't be a big ass with the license or something along those lines.
Well, actually, the language is that you have to operate in the public interest.
Right. Okay. Well, then,
that's the language.
Okay. So now we're going to let Trump define the public interest, which means him.
Well, but that's not his. That is not at this in this case. Okay. What we're talking about. I mean, look. Kimmel, in particular, all right, during Biden's presidency, was running skits promoting the clot shots. Now, what is a late night comedy host doing?
Well, because it, I'm not saying they should do that, but it becomes the news. I mean,
it was called the vaccine. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, hello.
Well, okay. I'm going to disagree with a lot of this stuff. I remember a political cartoonist. Are they left anymore? Are they around anymore?
Oh, there's a couple, but you know.
But I remember when Tricky Dick started going down a rat hole, every night the guy would draw a picture of him, and every night his nose would get bigger like Pinocchio.
Yeah.
You know, can you imagine that today?
Chief, but that's in a newspaper which doesn't have a monopoly on the public airwaves. The whole reason that this is not a factor for CNN, The View hasn't been threatened with being thrown off. All these things that are on CNN or Fox or whatever have you, there's no way to threaten them because they're not running on public licensed airways. The whole reason that you have this constraint within an FCC license is that there's only so much spectrum available for television stations and radio stations.
I'm saying, I'm not, whenever you go into the detail, I can't, This is the major discussion I have with most of our guests, is the detail has probably already been there. The progression,
it has.
It probably has, but if you were to walk around, most people in this country think that a TV or radio station has some sort of First Amendment right.
Well,
and okay, now nobody's ever said they haven't before, except maybe somebody like you read through it and said, you know, you're in a public interest. Now, who gets to define that?
Well, right? That changes.
But still, now you get an FCC guy on there saying, wait a minute, if we don't like what you're saying, basically, we can pull your license if you're detrimental to us.
Well, Chief, look.
You know who did that in 1932? It was Joseph Goebbels.
Oh, well, yeah. And you know
what was the name of that act? He was a brother. He was a brother to the media, and it got to the point where you had to apply and be approved by the Reich to be a reporter. No Jewish people.
And you know what? Why is it that you're seriously going to go down? You're going to play this Hitler game again, right?
No, not. I'm just saying that's what somebody else did. It's a fact.
Okay, you know what? And I can make the same argument when the Biden administration, which was proved because one of the people sued and got the discovery that they along.
Did I ever said? Here's the difference between me and the rest of the people on the show, to be perfectly honest with you. I look at something when Biden was an ass. I just said, Biden's an ass. I never said, oh, wait a minute, Bush did the same thing. What do I care? Bush is gone. Biden's gone. Chief, I don't care about that.
Chief, I don't recall you ever saying Biden's communications department.
The stuff that was going on with the COVID and everything?
Chief, I never heard you say anything about him being Goebbels.
I didn't say he was Goebbels. What I said was, during the Nazi thing...
You just drew the equivalence.
I didn't say that. Can I say the fact? Yesterday, I don't know if you were listening, I said, by the way, a lot of the stuff with the people here we want to get rid of everybody here who's not a citizen and doesn't belong here, whatever definition you want to use. All I said was, by the way, in 1882... we had all these Chinese people came over here, worked on the railroad, and when they were done, we wanted them the hell out of here. And we passed a law in 1882 saying, you got to go home, you got to go someplace, because we don't want you anymore, the job's done. I never said, oh, by the way, Trump's doing the same thing. What I said was, we have done this before in this country.
Yeah.
You know, and the same thing they do, what they did in France. The black people from Spain, where the hell were those guys? Where they brought them in there to do all this infrastructure work, and then when they were done, they couldn't wait to get rid of them. This isn't the first time it's happened. It's not just us, but let's just understand its history.
Well, of course it isn't the first time. All I'm saying is that when people draw a comparison against Nazi Germany...
I'm saying that there's a playbook if you want to go to this plutocracy thing, which it appears we're going, and I'm not saying it's Nazism at all. It's wealth. It's wealth.
Well, yeah. Now see, those are two different things.
I'm the one who's saying that. They're two different things.
But it's the same deal.
It's why Zuckerberg wants to control the polar wherever he's got. It's why these people, the Nazis didn't invent this.
Oh, of course they didn't. But
and
you know,
I'm saying if you want to be in charge, you don't want anybody criticizing you. Duh.
Well, duh.
Yeah. In our country, we've always said, well, guess what? You've got to be able to put yourself up to the criticism, or we don't want you. Now, all of a sudden, we're not doing that anymore for a while.
Well, and the other thing, I'll tell you that as I've pointed out many times, one of the ways in which you get around things that are blatantly unlawful. Right. It doesn't matter. I mean, there isn't an interpretive difference that you can draw. It's black letter illegal. Is you flood the zone with so much of it that trying to reverse it one person or one entity at a time would take 100 years, and therefore it'll never happen. Right. And that is and by the way, this applies on both sides of the aisle. Right. They're both like
these are the power playbooks. Do you think that the Tylenol situation, which you brought up, You think it has anything to do with anything other than we're blacking out news we don't want from yesterday?
Well, I don't. You know what? I don't know. All I know about the Tylenol thing in general, okay, in the general sense, is that the advice forever has always been, if you are pregnant or trying to get pregnant, do not take anything.
I would agree.
And the reason is, and the reason for that is, there is no ethically defensible way to study that, all right, whether or not it's okay. There's no ethically defensible.
Well, the big thing about against Tylenol, and you should know this as a guy who likes to tip one once in a while, never take Tylenol if you had alcohol. Blow your liver out? Do that.
Right. Well, the biggest problem with Tylenol is that the effective dose and the toxic dose to the liver are very close together.
All right, and if you're drinking, they're closer.
But the basic problem with the drug is that it is very hepatotoxic, and as a result, the margin, and people kill themselves. Thousands of people kill themselves accidentally overdosing.
You brought it up. What is the difference in dosage in Tylenol and extra strength that they might give you in a hospital? Is it double or triple? What is it?
I think it's basically like a double. I'd have to actually look it up, but
you probably can't take too many extra strengths without killing yourself.
Well, you may kill yourself, but screwing your liver up is no joke.
Yeah, I know.
And the thing is, I mean, I don't have any of it in the house. I won't use it because the toxicity profile is just too close to the effective one. And so I will not use it for that reason. And I have warned my daughter when she was growing up, because, you know, you get a headache or whatever, right? You're going to grab for something. I'm like, look, there are other options.
Everybody's going to say, let's not believe the chief again. I've never taken one of those ever, anything like that. I've taken a couple aspirin, maybe, somewhere along the line, maybe 10 years
aspirin,
ago.
Aspirin, we understand where the risk factors are for that, okay? And you could poison yourself with aspirin, too. And, in fact, a lot of the people in 1918 that died of the swine flu actually died of aspirin poisoning.
Yeah.
Because people were gobbling the stuff like it was candy. And they essentially they killed themselves.
But, you know, but honestly, I've never taken a Tylenol or never taken anything like that. Because I don't – I played golf with people when I used to play. And I said, boy, my back's bucking me at this age at 18.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we took a couple of something. Not, what's the other one you take?
The ibuprofen is the other one.
And that's
But that one is safer.
But I don't want to mask anything. I don't want to take three Tylenol because I have a headache and all of a sudden I had an aneurysm and I couldn't feel it and I blew my head up and I don't want to
That would be bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, then we don't have Chief anymore.
Well, you know what? I'm not so sure. I'll tell you what, my investors would miss me. Well, the guys I manage money for would miss me, I think. A couple of people in the family, and I'm not sure about anybody else. You know that goes. Little Maggie the dog, she'd miss me. I wonder when we have all this crap going on, you know, because there's a lot of themes to the show. When we have this stuff going on and we're fighting all these crazy battles, and I want to get our buddy Bill Moriarty back on. How in the midst of all this are you going to have an administration all of a sudden? It's any administration. We're in this chaos. Obviously, it didn't happen during Biden. It wasn't run the way I wanted it run. And this whole thing, how do we find the right people to do what you wanted to do last week? You know, put the somehow finance... approve the breeder reactor. And there's probably 50 things in this country we want to do like that. How does all that... I can't imagine in the chaos here in Chicago, that's why I want to have Bill Moriarty on again, how the hell if we decided because the suburbs now, you know, they're continuing to grow a little bit, how could we ever decide we needed an additional water treatment plant or something? How could we get through all the fighting, all the stuff, and get that thing up and running in 7 or 8 years? I can't even imagine it, Carl. We're so worried about, you know, we're kicking workers out of the country. We're doing this, we're doing that. Simple fact is, we want stuff for people to work on. including people here and maybe people from somewhere else if we need them. I don't. We're losing track of all that. Are we doing the stuff? Is half the infrastructure bill even spent? Are we even doing the projects?
Well,
we obviously need. I mean, what is the mechanism of the government right now in the city here? I think it's horse bleep. Now, is it as bad on a federal level? It might be.
Yeah, it is, and it's not just Chicago. Right? I mean, you look at all the howling that's going on out in California over this express train thing, right? It has not laid a single mile of actual functional track.
Don't get me started on that.
All right. And yet billions of dollars have been, it's essentially a ditch digging program that after you get done digging it, you fill it back in and start over, right? I mean, and I get it. They've got like one overpass up or something, you know, something like this. But this has been going on for how long now?
Carl, now you went and got me started. Why do you do that? When we did a lot of research on this at Pullman, and I'll say this: the single biggest issue. And this is America. This is now you can. I'm not saying anything against this administration or another one. This is as old as the Buttonwood tree.
I know that.
When people left the Transcontinental Railroad, which I was talking about yesterday, the Chinese people, we didn't want them here anymore. Afterward, right? Get the hell out of here. We don't need you anymore. Well, going west was mostly Irish people. Coming east, they didn't have enough white people, so they ended up hiring Chinese people, which was a big hue and cry at the time, right? Because people said, okay, when they're done with the railroad, what are we going to do with them? We don't want them here. It wasn't like it was a new argument, right? I mean, duh. So, but going from Council Bluffs, Council Bluffs and I, from Omaha, we started to go west. Actually, if ever you're on a Who Wants to Be a Millionaire show, if they have that anymore, if they were to ask you, what's the last piece of the Transcontinental Railroad, what would you say?
Oh, God.
You'd say the Golden Spike at Promontory Point.
Yeah, but that wasn't.
No, it wasn't. It was the bridge over the Missouri River.
Yeah, okay. All right. See, I knew it wasn't the Golden Spike, right? But I didn't know precisely where the last connection was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, all right, so...
But here, let me say, they were getting paid... Essentially, they got all the land, a lot of land on both sides, right? So that's how the railroads were paid. So they were paid somehow by trackage. So yeah. Colonel Dodge, who was the engineer on the whole thing, went to Washington for 2 or 3 months to continue to get funding. He comes back and he finds out that the first like 90 miles could have been like 70 miles. it was known as the Great Oxbow. they made a big curve on it so they could get 90 miles of funding or whatever it was over 70 miles of track.
He's
totally pissed off. That's why if you go to any city, go to where else, University of Nebraska, Lincoln, the main drag is going to be Dodge Street. Same thing in Omaha, it's Dodge Street. It's because Colonel Dodge, right?
No, I know.
Yeah, but those guys, they every dirty trick that basically anybody's ever done. Enron had a read. There was the Union Pacific going west and the Central Pacific coming east. The guys who ran the Central Pacific were getting the money for the trackage, and they go, wait a minute, one of them essentially hired somebody else out. They paid them to actually make the tracks lay the tracks. And those guys were executives of the other place, essentially bankrupted the initial shareholders. Then the second place took over.
And then they got
a much bigger piece of the pie. Does that sound like Enron or what?
Yeah, and they got the capital asset for free, essentially. Yeah. 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 But here's the other thing that I... All right, so since we're all on bad news, let's have some good news.
The good news is, are they going to build this breeder reactor?
No, let's leave my... Right. Let me go here with the good news, okay? All right. So the FTC is now after Spamazon, okay, on Prime. All right, basically their argument is that people end up paying for it without realizing that they've bought it, and Amazon makes it hard to cancel it. All right.
Is the same Amazon or is it Walmart that was selling the wrong stuff the other day?
That's a separate thing. Okay. This is specifically related to Prime. All right, now here's the thing that's interesting is that the FTC in 2023, okay, which of course is, you know, when Biden was in office, brought a case that they were an illegal monopoly, and that, by the way, is going to trial in another couple of years.
So what good is it? 10 years.
The point being this: the FTC has been after these issues across various industries. Okay, with Amazon, with Uber, with Match, with Chegg, with a couple of Chegg is an online education company. Uber, of course, you know, we know who Uber is, right? They're the taxi cab displacers. So they've been doing this across a bunch of these with what they're calling dark patterns, which is their term that they coined for it, which is essentially a mechanistic means that a corporation uses to screw people out of paying for subscriptions they didn't want, okay, and make them very difficult to kill when you realize you're paying for something you're not using and you don't want.
Sounds like a timeshare.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But the point being that even though there has been, you know, I'm going to fire this guy, I'm going to bring this guy in, I'm going to do this, you know, all the way across the board, that this pattern of enforcement actions is surviving across these, you know, across administrations, which is good.
But they're doing the same thing that they always do today that people recognize was wrong 3 years ago.
Well, I get that, but then we got another one just a couple of days ago, which is Trump slamming the door in the H-1B thing, which has been a screaming point of mine for the last 20 years.
But for totally different reasons.
Well, look, I...
Because I'm aware of your... By the way, I know it's hard for me to do this. I agree with you, but that's not the reason why he did it.
Well, Chief, I understand that the reason that he did it may very well... I have my own theory on that, okay? And one of them is that India is buying Russian oil.
Yeah.
And this is his way of sticking their nuts in the vice.
Well, how happy were you when your coffee went up 10% this week because he doesn't like the fact they prosecuted his buddy in Brazil?
Well, I've still got 10 pounds of.
At the Myers, they don't have that. They play it.
Well, guess what? I know what's going to happen to me.
Can you let me Carl has, by the way, in one of his educational things he has told the show over the years. Is the HB1 visa is now? It was used a lot in. Tell me where I'm wrong here, because I'm trying to delineate why I agree with you totally, and yet I'm not so sure I agree with what happened yesterday. Carl has been saying that if you identify a bunch of students from wherever, China, Thailand, you name it, and they're in Stanford and all these places out west, and all of a sudden their student visa expires, and you can get them this HB1 visa. Microsoft or somebody, actually they're in Seattle, but somebody there can go get this kid, get an HB1, sponsor him for an HB1 visa, and he can only work for that company at a certain amount of dough. And Carl has always mentioned, I'm talking about you like you're not here, Carl has always said the going rate for this job might be $100 and a quarter, but if they can snag this kid on an HB1 visa, they might be able to only have to pay $75.
Well, it's actually worse than that.
But he gets 3 months, then he can extend it to 6, correct?
It's 3 years.
Oh, 3 years, okay. But he can't go down the block. If I say, boy, I like Joe, I'd be happy to pay him going rate, he can't go.
So the day
you explain that, I've been against these things for that reason.
Right, because the visa's connected to the employer.
Right. And if his wife comes with him, her visa's connected to his, she can work, but she has to have like another, what's the EAD document, went through all this stuff yesterday. To me has been that's being somewhat of a slave, honestly, but it's not a...
Well, it is.
But for 3 years, you are, basically.
Well, but then here's the other thing. There's two other abuses that go with this. One is what's called the perm process, where these people come in here. The explicit purpose of the H-1B was to allow companies to, on a temporary basis, hire people they couldn't get in the United States during the period
grand
of time.
Savings over 3 years is real dough.
Well, but hold on a minute. It doesn't end there. Right? Okay. That's the problem.
Well, how easy is it to extend it from 3 to 6?
It's worse than that. The company can sponsor a perm petition to get you a green card.
Yeah, but once you get a green card, you can go anywhere you want, right?
Well, in theory. However, then you get into the chain migration problem that comes with that, because once you have that, you can start bringing over your family members.
Actually, you can bring them over on the HB1.
You can bring over your spouse.
And kids.
And direct children, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing is that then, you know, then the spider web expansion gets into this. And the original purpose of the H-1 was it's a non-immigrant visa. So the ability to convert it is a perversion that was never intended in the law. And as it originally stood, and this, Chief, the wage floor for an H-1 is $60,000, okay? In other words, you have to pay at least that. Do you know that?
Well, in Silicon Valley, it's a bargain.
Well, by the way, okay, just as a point of order here, when I was in the process of setting up an MCS, running it out of my closet in my apartment, until you have some revenue, obviously, you have to have a way to make some dough, right? Because you have to pay the rent. So I was doing contract work for a job shop. My rate to me, not what they were charging the employer, but to me, was 40 an hour. That's 80 grand a year.
Yeah.
That was in the early 1990s.
Okay, well, see, now this could be done.
Now, see, here's the thing. They would have been better off hiring an H-1B because it would have cost less than what it cost to hire me.
All right, so.
Now, this was, by the way, when I was nowhere near as skilled as I am now, obviously. Duh, right? But on the thing is, where's the inflation adjustment on this wage floor
for
the last 30 years?
Here's my continual concern with this, I'm going to say, administration. Now, what we just discussed is the problems with this system.
Yeah.
Okay. Economically, I still have an economic...
They screw Americans.
Okay. I know that. And you and I agree on that. I know how hard it is to agree on somebody with some of my guests. What Trump did yesterday makes it worse, not better.
How? How does it make it worse?
Because in order for you to pay the $100,000, you have to be screwing the person on the 3-year salary for more than $100,000, correct? It's not fixing.
No, that's not true.
Why?
Why would you pay the $100,000 instead of hiring the, now it's $160,000 for the
okay,
first
now,
year.
Okay, right, now it's
okay. Why would I do that instead of paying an American 80?
It's do the math, my friend. We're so anxious to. Now we said just out of the blue, we picked a couple of numbers up. We said, okay, the guy is going to get paid $60,000 in a job in Silicon Valley that's worth $100,000. That when you and I, those are the numbers we used before COVID, Carl. You and I were talking when we discussed this. What if now the number is 70 versus 150? I'm paying $100,000, and guess what? I'm only going to pay him $60,000. Screw him.
But you're not.
Well, it has nothing to do with fixing the problem. It's giving the government $100,000.
No, it's not, because why? All right, look, you're arguing that labor isn't fungible. Yes, it is. Okay, especially at the lower end.
I'm saying if the difference that you're paying in the three years. Is more than $100,000. It still might be something you do. Is all I'm saying. I'm just in an economic area.
Okay. You still might do it. However,
if the difference now has grown in the 5 years since we talked about it, if it's grown to where you're saving $200,000 in this guy, I'm pissed off. I got to give Trump the $100,000, but I'm going to do it.
But Chief, if it's $200,000, all right. So it was $180,000 for the 3 years before. Okay. Now it's $280,000. Because you have to plus up the first year for the
I'm not talking about what you're paying. I'm talking about what you're saving.
No. It's 280. So now, if the American is cheaper than 90 or cheaper, you hire the American.
I think that's probably not the case.
Why would it not be the case?
Because the numbers we used 5 years ago was a difference of 40. I'm just remembering the conversation. I'm saying.
Look, what I'm arguing is that, and now I don't like the path that was taken to get to the result.
What was the old fee?
There was no fee, basically.
Yeah,
it was like 5 or something like that.
Yeah, okay. So this is the so you used to have to pay the government $5,000 to screw an American guy by bringing somebody here is essentially a chattel for 3 years and pay him less, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So now it's the same argument. Are you a hooker or not? Yes, you are. We're just arguing the price. Okay. Now the price of doing that is $100, not $5. Right.
Chief, excuse me. Everybody in business is a whore.
Well, and to the extent that you let your morality go out the door and you'll do business with anybody for a price, it's a problem. How many people here? I'll back to my Hitler analogy. How many people here would have done business with the guy if he would have waited 3 years to invade Poland? Everybody.
Well, how many people did do business with him in the run up to it?
Yeah,
everybody.
Everybody's trying to. Yeah. But what I'm saying is, there was $5,000 and some pain in the ass time for a corporation to get somebody here for 3 years that couldn't go anywhere else. Who knows if you had to pay him overtime or not? Who's he going to complain to, right? So you got somebody talented, cheap, for 3 years, for $5,000, and now the number is $100, and anybody in that business is going to go to a young chief and say, okay, who is it still worth it for us to do this for? I know that, because I was the guy who they sent this kind of stuff to.
And the answer
is going to be, well, we'll have 10 guys this year instead of 25, because we'll get the right 10 guys.
Well, okay, except here's the thing. Chief, the purpose of the program, okay? And I go back to
what is the purpose of the program?
the reason the program exists is because there are people from all over the world, all right, who really are the top half of 1% of their field. All
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
There are people that are several cuts above my class in computer programming, right? Network design. All right. And I'm pretty good at it. But there is some group of people. I mean, the biggest error you can ever commit is to think you're the smartest guy in the room. All right, there's always going to be someone who's got better chops than you do. I don't care who it is, you know, where you stand in a particular field. The idea of the H-1B was to, on a temporary basis, allow those people to come into the United States and work at a premium rate, because I can't get that skill set in the U.S.
No, and it dissolved to be something different, which it always happens.
Right, and so the point of it is, if I have to pay that $100,000 fee, but the guy's really worth $5,000, I don't care.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, you care. You'd rather pay $5,000.
Well, I'd rather pay $5,000 than $6,000. But at the end of the day, if he's that good, I don't care.
Hey,
all right.
We have to get him. But let's. You know what else I want to talk about on Friday is, the amount of, I was reading these reports, the amount of farm bankruptcies between the not shipping stuff overseas and the markets kind of drying up and not being able to get workers, and by the way, the price is down this year anyway. We had four more farm bankruptcies in the first quarter this year than we did the entire last year. But I have a question for you. If I always keep talking about Bill Moriarty. If Bill's firm he used to work for gets a contract for a dam or a water treatment plant in any other country, and we're going to bring, you're probably going to need, there's got to be some attempt to hire workers in the other country, but by and large, you're going to have to bring a core group from here to wherever, Saudi or, wherever it happens to be. Hopefully not Sudan, I wouldn't want to be that guy, but how does that work? Do those guys have something equivalent of an HB1 from the other country? Is it part of the contract is signed with the government, so there's clauses in there for employment? How does that all work? Can we bring, I'm talking about the factory down in wherever, the Korean guys, and I don't know what happened there, so I don't want to get into it and say anybody was right or wrong, but how do we pull it off? Or if we're building some plant here, and like Bill said, well, you might have a whole bunch of guys in Britain that just put in the same kind of plant in France, and we're going to bring those guys here for 3 years. How does that all work? Does there have to be visas, or is it part of the contract, or does anybody know?
Well, you so there is a formal process, okay, because, you know, I have, in a former life, I have traveled internationally in order to, you know, conduct business, okay? And there are two aspects of that. There's one which is essentially, for most countries, it doesn't have a different kind of visa requirement. So if I'm going over to negotiate a business deal, say in Japan, there's no special application process to do that, because number one, I'm only going to be in the country for a few days. But the other thing is as long as I honestly declare when I'm entering, why I'm going.
I'm talking about more the whole build process. I mean, how did
right? But that's all right. So that's
day one for you to go over there just to do the deal. It's a regular old visa.
That's a regular visa. But now,
or no visa? Do you need a visa to go to Japan?
No, typically you don't. But I mean, you have to have. They do stamp your passport though.
Right.
But then you have the second level, which is I'm going to sit there for 3 months or 6 months or a year or whatever and build this plant, okay? That is an entirely different thing. Now you're talking about essentially a foreign work permit, all right? And that even applies if you go to do something like that in Canada.
So even like if you bring over four executives or engineers, those guys need a...
Oh, hell yes. And you need formal permission from the government to do that. And by the way, in a lot of areas, like as I've pointed out, I know somebody who went to shoot a wedding in Canada and got busted because they did not have the correct work permit to do that. All right, and they got escorted back to the line by the Mounties and given a 5-year ban on reentry for any reason.
This piques my interest because Pullman had a licensing deal with Gonin in Australia that makes railroad cars, and they used a lot of the Pullman engineering. And when they were doing a car, and we sent a guy over, first a guy named Joe Ginta, to get him started on the fabrication part. Then we sent Bob Johnson over there, Pullman. They're both there like 6 months, so they would have had to have some kind of a special deal to bring the family over and live and work for 6 months.
Yeah.
Joe Ginta, he was a character.
You can get those visas, but the thing is what.
Well, I mean, Gonin. I mean, everybody knew they were getting the licensing from Pullman and getting some consulting work, so
right.
It probably was relatively easy to get, right? But
well, if you're not trying to play a game of some kind, it's normally not very difficult, but you do have to go through the process.
Okay.
It's not.
And if you bring over,
I'm going to fly in and do it.
If you bring over 100 workers, and the deal is you hire 200 there and 100 of your guys, and you train them to run the place as part of the deal, then it has to be another pretty complicated thing, right?
Well, and the thing is it does require formal approval of the government that where the foreign nationals are coming into. And it's not perfunctory. You have to make that application. There may be some fees involved and some monitoring because the other nation is very interested in you not replacing their people.
Yeah. Oh, the idea is to train them.
Well, yeah. The idea is to train them, then you go home.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. And that's and most nations, I mean, you know, including the United States, we're very open to that sort of thing, provided that's what you're actually doing.
Yeah. What kind of the key question, I guess, in all this stuff. If it's done properly, this all should be able to get done. I mean, it's.
Oh, there's no problem with that sort of a thing, provided it's not done under the table. If you try to use subterfuge in some way, then you're screwing people, and at that point, the government is going to come down on you and should.
Do we have Professor Hal? Is he in the room?
We do. He's in the room.
How come he's being so quiet?
What's up? I've been on the Zoom call since 30 after, just listening.
He's usually not so... he usually likes to out people a little more than that.
Well, you know, we'll let you guys go at it, and I'll be back at you Friday.
Yeah, let's talk about this farm thing on Friday, because every time I think of that, I think about 1929 and how the farmers were in a depression and the rest of the people were buying Duesenbergs, and all of a sudden one day, not so good.
Yeah, well, I think I don't know where the trigger's going to be, but I do believe it's coming.
What... last question for you and for Hal. I am absolutely ecstatic about what's going on in the metals because my people have been very over-invested in there for a long time, and all of a sudden...
Yeah, all of a sudden it pays.
Well, yeah, I'm all of a sudden the last 3 months I'm a genius, right? Well, after 3 years of being early. But it's all come home to roost, but now what? Are we...
Well,
is this over, or are we just starting? Is there something going on here?
I think you got to be a little careful with this, because the number of people over the decades who have predicted end of the dollar only to find that oops, that's not what happened, is fairly, you know, you can make a big stack with that number of bodies, right?
Well, I agree. I'm with you.
Yeah.
Besides, you know, the trader mentality is, if you buy something at 20, it's at 25. It's nowhere near as good at 25 as it was at 20. So you want to lighten up, right? That's always been my mentality.
But people don't look at that; they double into it because it's, you know, well, it's going to go to 50, right? And I I look at silver and gold and stuff like that, and it's easy to say, well, you know, woulda, shoulda, coulda, right? But boy, I'll tell you what, piling in after you've had a big move, sometimes it pays and it keeps going.
Well, I would never pile in. Every time it goes up $4 or $5, which used to take like a year, now it takes a couple of days. We roll the puts up just in case.
Right.
I'm saying, I guess the question I'm asking here, and Al, please opine, what's happening to gold? I say this 4 times a week, and nobody, even the people on the show, haven't agree with me at all. It's not about gold. It's about the dollar. And if
it's about the dollar, yeah.
If the current administration, and they're not the first to have done it, so you know, we go back to, you know, who was around, and was probably Nixon. I mean, and it hasn't always been. I'd say the biggest abuser was Obama, because there was no problem during his 8 years, except they expanded the money supply 5% when the growth was 1 or 2. So there's been abusers all along the line. Everybody's picked up this game from the Dutch, for God's sake, were the first ones. But I mean, if we're going to, you know, gold's pretty damn high here, in my opinion. If these guys are going to throw people off the Fed, put God knows who on there, and they're going to push money supply growth 8% for the next 3.5 years, I'm going to say gold's just starting.
I'll say this, and then I'll go ahead and let Hal opine for how long he wants. If in fact we're going to get that, and it doesn't lead to a fallback, which, you know, you don't go over the edge of the waterfall, right?
Yeah, which we haven't yet.
We haven't yet. But if they somehow manage to get away with running, 8-9% fiscal deficits financed through the Federal Reserve, which is clearly what this new guy that, you know, Trump's guy is arguing for, right?
Yep.
If that is in fact what they do, and they get away with it, and the and is very important, then yeah, metals are probably going to continue to outperform. My concern is that if the market wakes up and says, hey, wait a minute, this is an exponential series and we can't allow this to go on, you're going to see all leveraged assets come down in price, and not small, because the long end of the curve is going to explode higher, and there's going to be nothing the Fed can do about it.
For that happen, I would say that day would be Rick Santelli, who's still on CNBC, is going to do a 30-year auction. He's going to go, what the bleep? We're not 4.8 anymore. We're 6.2 as of today, and that day will be a bad one.
And you know what? That's exactly it. If it happens, you'll get no warning.
Except him standing there going, you won't believe what just happened. Because Chinese, aren't the Chinese supposedly buying gold instead of buying treasuries? Isn't that part of the deal? I don't know. You read this stuff, you don't know if people are right or wrong.
You know, the problem is that international flows can be very difficult to nail down, because people do try to hide them through intermediaries.
Well, they're a much smaller percentage of the U.S. treasuries than they have been in 10 years, right?
That's true, yes.
So I don't know how much they're cutting back or what they're doing, but... Anyway, good. Thanks for covering, Joel. Today's a holiday of some sort. I don't know what it is, but the
Rosh Hashanah. It's the Jewish New Year.
Oh, we're Rosh Hashanah. There it is then. So he's off for that, and Kenny's traveling, I believe. So we'll have those guys back next week. But thank you for covering. So Hal, what's up, buddy?
Oh, not much. I just read an article this weekend about the $7+ trillion. In money market funds, and you guys were talking about what the Fed's been doing. If you look at just money market funds over the last, since 1980.
Yeah.
It was essentially at zero in the 1980s, and now it's sitting at $7 trillion. So, I mean, it's right. I mean, the Federal Reserve is the catalyst to all this inflation. And I think the reason why it is, even though it doesn't, it's not the, it doesn't create most of the money in a given year. Banks, through lending, create the most money in a given year. What it does is, as lender of last resort, that creates a huge moral hazard. If it wasn't, if the Fed wasn't here and wasn't guaranteeing these deposits, then I think you would see a lot less lending. Banks would be a little more frugal. They'd be a little more careful with the people's money. But yeah, this chart is just incredible. The money.
Well, look at the last 5 months in margin loans, for God's sake.
Oh yeah, the margin loans are.
They actually were
hanging
in
there. The ones that we know of. Are over a trillion.
Yeah, these are FINRAs.
Executive prints.
Yeah, these are FINRAs, but the last 3 or 4 months are up $50 billion a month. And what we're talking about here Hal's always on me about the mechanism, and so's Carl a little bit, but the mechanism really almost doesn't matter. I mean, I'm going to be very simple about this. I mean, everybody, I think, knows how a stock split works. Okay, now, forget the fact that a dollar is sacred, it's in your pocket. You know, you've known what it was since you were 2 years old, for God's sake. Especially in the Midwest, you've never known anything else. You never went out of this country. That's your dollar. It's your mighty friggin' dollar. And as American, we all believe that to a certain extent, right? Well, yeah. take a stock, for instance. Stock's trading $80, and we're going to say, we don't want it $80, we want it at $40. You know, people used to think that because they said more people could buy it at 40 than 80. In those days, the commissions are more expensive for an odd lot, and by the way, you can't do an option on less than 100 shares, so you want people to be able to have at least 100 shares, called a round lot, correct? And so people would say, all right, when you got to 80, let's split it. Now, when you say split it, you're not splitting anything, right? So when you do the math on this, what exactly, now you know this, what exactly is a stock split?
Well, you just turn one into two.
It's 100% stock dividend.
The value, this value, I mean, if you bought it for 1,000 and they split it, now each is 500, right?
Right. Well, so if you've got 100 shares, now you've got 200 shares. Yeah. The company's worth X. You're dividing it by twice as many shares. Guess what? The price ends up being half because you did the math. But really what happened is if you had 500 shares, back when people had certificates, they sent you in the mail another 500. If you got an account at PTI, you had 500. Guess what? Tomorrow you got 1,000. And the price goes down by half because that's the mechanism. That's the logic to it, right? Because the company.
You know, Tom, I've never bought a stock. Do they actually send you the certificate now? Or
oh, God, no.
Does this exist in some computer database?
As a matter of fact, yet another.
Can you request the certificate?
No. No real print one out. I mean, no, you could request it. I don't know. But here's even worse. And this is why, you know, I have this, even though.
So if the computer blitzes out and they don't have a backup copy, you don't own the stock.
The guy at the transfer agent probably has some record of, they have to send you the dividends.
If there's an EMP above the United States and all the computers are wiped out, you don't own the stock. Cause you have a certificate.
No, they have records because they've been sending you the dividend. They know you got it. I mean, if you got a, if you still had 100, you know, 1,000 shares.
Like if I had the money, I'd be buying like an ounce of gold. I'd want the paper. I'd want the actual literal title.
You want the gold. You don't want the paper.
No, I don't want the paper. I want the title of the company. I want the title of the company in the form of a stock.
Well, here's
and here, I want the actual physical gold.
Well, here's what's happened in the world that you may know about because you're on the show and you're a bright guy. If you have any paper certificates, say for instance, you know, a real smart guy like Hal Snar did some consulting work for XYZ 5 years ago, and the guy said, well, how about if I give you $50,000 and they already have shares outstanding, and you say, you know, I kind of believe in this country, how about giving me 2,000 shares, and the guy scribbles you out, or they give you a certificate through whoever does their stuff. You've got the certificate. And one day the stock's doing pretty well, and you say, hey, chief, you like run a brokerage firm, or my brother does, and I'm here, and how about if I give you my 2,000 shares paper? I'm going to go, eh. First of all, IB won't take it at all. RBC, if you've had an account here for maybe 4 years and have a minimum of like 50 grand in it, they might take it. They're going to accuse you of being a money launderer. Seriously. Somehow or another, paper stock certificates are now considered to be an amazing way for people to launder money. So if you happen to be a consultant, you probably would almost have to call the place up and have them buy it back for you or something. Yeah. But we've done it, but it's a royal pain in the ass. And
have you seen a Blast from the Past with Brendan Fraser?
There's no way. Let's put it that way. There's no way you could open an account with that as your lead in, because they're going to think you're a money launderer. And you know what? I don't. You know, my personality. I mean, everybody argues with me, but which is fine. I don't give a shit if this is what you want to do, okay, as a government. I just want them to have the balls to say on Wall Street Journal one day, hey, if you're sending paper certificates to your brokerage firm, it's not their fault. We're the ones calling you a money launderer, and guess what? That thing's not worth anything anymore. And at least take the blame. Don't make us look like the bad guys because we can't do anything with it.
Yeah.
Try and walk into Merrill Lynch with 5,000 shares of some of some stock on the pink sheets or something.
You need to watch that movie with Brendan Fraser called Blast from the Past.
Yeah,
Christopher Walken is awesome in it, and Brendan Fraser and his dad and his mom, Sissy Spacek, they're all in a bunker, and they come out of the bunker like mid 1990s. You know, they went into the bunker in the 1960s, and they come out of the bunker in the 1990s. And they're extremely wealthy because the dad bought a bunch of stock certificates. And Brendan Fraser goes around and kind of sells some of them. And he ends up building his mom and dad a replica, because his dad is kind of a crazy, kooky guy. He builds him a replica of the bunker and on top of the ground. So it's pretty good, actually. But I think he owned AT&T stock before the federal government broke up the company, so it would have been called Ma Bell or something.
By the way, I when my nephews and niece were born, and I was trading, and shall we say, had a lot of disposable income, I bought them when they were born a bunch of AT&T stock. And they put it in the dividend reinvestment program, known as a DRIP program.
Has it always been called AT&T?
It was American Telephone and Telegraph.
Okay. When did they start using the initials?
Well, I mean, the first one, the overseas group, was ITT, International Telephone and Telegraph, and then this was American. And they did everything that was part of the system they did.
They were called Ma Bell, right?
Oh, yeah. It was all made out in Western Electric, out in Cicero, or the Hawthorne plant. Yeah. My uncle worked there. It was 30,000 people... 24/6, maybe not Saturday, but there were three shifts. Everything was from the big huge things we used to hang all the wires in, what they used to call those things, down to every single phone you bought from them. Yeah. But the quality of the stuff, if you got a Bell phone, I still have one at home. Every once in a while,
that thing would survive a nuclear weapon.
They survive everything. when they broke apart. Somebody, before there were really ETFs, somebody tried to put together a fund to keep them together, and it only lasted about a year. And I'm like, because what happened was, we got up to I don't know how many shares, because the DRIP program, they would, if you, instead of sending you the dividend, they would buy shares, even if it was fractional shares, and they buy it for you at 90% of market value with no commission. The company would do it. So it was a terrific program for some kids, as an investment program. Plus, if you got if Uncle Hal gave each kid $500 for Christmas, you could send the check to AT&T and they would buy shares for you, no commission, and dump it in your account. So there, a zillion people had these little accounts at AT&T.
Well, it's a really good business model because it creates this buy-in with young people. to continue the monopoly, right?
Well, it wasn't the company. I mean, they just happened to be a monopoly. But then when they broke them up, all the shares got broken up too.
Yeah.
It was, I think it was seven, maybe. Ameritech was the old Western Electric in the Midwest. There was Bell South. There was Bell Northeast. I think there might have been seven. So my brother tried to keep track of this for, you know, with seven now, dividend reinvestment program. Finally, he sold them all and he put it in something else. That was GE or something. I don't know. But they were the most. And also, Lucent was part of the spinoff because they were Bell Labs.
Yeah.
And Lucent became the most widely held stock essentially in the world.
Rand, I think Rand was a part of it too, right?
No, that was Sperry Rand. I don't. That was different. That was a computer. I don't know who will gobble those guys up. But anyway, to get back to our this is the part I have problems explaining, and you do too, because not in your class. If there's a stock split, okay, and all of a sudden everybody gets twice as many shares, anybody, the biggest dumb dumb on earth, realizes, okay, wait a minute, everything's half price, right? And we're just going to go from there. I now have 200 shares at 40 instead of 100 shares at 80. Duh. But now, if the government does that with the dollar, which is essentially the stock, right? If they were to say, we're going to double the money supply tomorrow. So if you walked in with your Washington and came out with your Jefferson, right? A Jefferson being a $2 bill, right? I think Jefferson is $2. I think it is. So if you walk in with a 10, the Federal Reserve gives you a 20, what would happen? The price of a car would be 15 grand, well, way more than that now. All of a sudden, the price of a car is 30 grand. If I owe you 20 bucks from golf for last week, I now owe you 40, right?
Everybody, yeah, you remember, those effects aren't evenly distributed throughout the economy.
Well, I'm saying, if it was the same way, nobody would care, would they?
Yeah.
But it's not the same way, which is what you and I talk about every week. When you leak it in a little bit.
When they pump the dollars out,
yeah,
the people that get those dollars first.
Somebody get them first.
They benefit mightily because they get to buy assets that are uninflated yet. By the time that money makes it to us, all these prices have gone up.
Well, some people have.
That's the Cantillon effect.
Well, some people have. I don't know if it's the Cantillon effect. Some firms have buying power.
Richard Cantillon, man, you got to read about him. Tom, the guy was an incredible economist for his day. His models still work today.
Okay, but we're talking about on two different levels. And for every individual firm, some people have pricing power and some don't. And a guy like you could put this all, I used to say, on a chart. Now you'd put it on some computer thing. If all of a sudden, the general price level goes up. Like I said, if everybody went up 10%, and everybody's wage went up 10%, nobody'd care, right? But that's not what's happening.
Care.
Now,
yeah.
But some companies, like Walmart, has pricing power. They think they don't, but they do. There's not going to be a day on earth where they don't. I mean, there's each individual product, maybe not, because they don't have as much, you know. But on the whole, if the prices come to Walmart and are up 10% across the board, which they wouldn't be, they're all individual, like you and I talk about, they're going to at least be able to raise them 11. Now, they're probably not going to want to raise them any more than that. Or maybe they don't even want to raise them more than the 10, but they're going to get a chance to do that. But PTI can't do that. We don't have any pricing power. I mean, we have our stuff for our people. And you know, we charge X for commission. But we don't the minute we see the CPI up 5%, we don't raise prices 5%.
I don't think Walmart has as much pricing power as people think they do, because I know a lot of people.
A lot of individual products, they don't.
Yeah. My Aunt Kathy, for example, if she knew the price would, if she expected the price to be lower at one store, she would literally drive from store to store to store, and she would figure out which group of products are the cheapest at each different store. And she'd walk away with 10 bags of groceries. And all, she didn't care about driving around. She went from store to store looking for the cheapest type of bread, the cheapest type of this, the cheapest type of that. And I think a lot of people do that, because driving around in aggregate doesn't really amount to much. But I really don't think Walmart has the pricing power that we think they do. They have to compete with things like Amazon and other grocery stores.
I'm lobbing out examples. I would say, and again, boy, you know how hard it is to agree with people on the show? I'm going to say you're they don't have near the pricing power that Home Depot does.
Well, you know, I don't think Home Depot has pricing power too, because Home Depot for the longest time didn't have a military discount. Lowe's did, and Lowe's was getting all these veterans because Lowe's has parking spots for veterans, and they give them 10% off their purchases.
What community?
All of a sudden, Home Depot rolls out a veterans discount. So I don't think Home Depot, because it's usually located across the street from a Lowe's. I think Home Depot has a pricing power that we think they have.
I'm going to say in 60% of the country, you either have a Home Depot or a Lowe's. And if you're not in the Midwest, where you don't have a Menards, we have a Menards, which keeps those guys a little bit in line. What I'm saying is, do they have absolutely unlimited pricing power? No. Nobody does. But if you go and get, if the price of wood goes up 10%, it's not going to go up. If it goes up 10% to them, okay, and they double the price to you in general, then it's really only 5%, right? So if they raise it even 6% to you, they're ahead of the game, correct?
Well, I mean, if lumber goes up 10%, one, they're going to be looking for a new supplier. That's the first thing you're going to do.
There's not that many suppliers.
If their current supplier is going up 10%, they're going to start looking for a different supplier.
But
they could look for a farmer.
They're not going to do
Oregon.
That. They're not going to do that. They have suppliers that they have to get 2x4s at a certain price for 1,000 stores.
Yeah.
The fact that you're going to sell them 10 trees cheaper.
If those prices go up too much, they're going to be looking for new sources.
I understand it. My point is, everybody has different ability to pass the prices through.
Yeah.
That's my only point. Some people do, some people don't. And it's also on any...
That depends on how much competition you have. If there's no...
And I'm saying there's very little in some towns.
Yeah. Well, also, if these prices go up dramatically, then some guy comes out with a product, a composite product, for example, that's made from recycled materials. And another person goes, hey, that's a good idea. I'm going to make it even better. So over the long run, you get these products that are substitutable. They're close substitutes, perfect substitutes.
You're the guy who knows all this. I don't know why you're arguing with me. Let's take Professor Hill, and he goes into the Home Depot, and he's going to buy 2x4s, and he's got a project in 3 weeks, and he needs 50 2x4s. He's going to load them onto his truck, or in your case, you make your kids do it, probably. so the 2x4s used to be $10 a piece. And guess what? Now they're $14. And you sit there and go, they're not the only person who've raised the price of 2x4s, because they've come, you know, whether it's a tariff from Canada or whether the prices are just, who knows, the fact is they're up. So you're going to sit there and you're going to do that. And then you're probably going to say, now if the job is today, and your guy who's doing your job says, I need 500 of this kind of nail, you're going to walk in the nail aisle and you're going to buy the nails. Now, me being the sneaky fellow that I am, I'm going to say the 2x4s are pretty damn competitive. Nails, maybe not so much. And I'm going to bet the markup on the nails is 5 times what it is on a 2x4. Now, you can go home to your house or your office online, because I do this, and you can go into... There's a couple of places in Iowa. One is Fasteners Plus, where I got all the stuff for my when I do redoing the deck, and I probably saved 20-25% from Home Depot. Okay, now, but I was smart enough to do that. But if you only want something for your deck, which isn't the same as the big thing we put up in the back, in a 4-story place, you're going to find that if your fasteners are $100. And you go online and they're $80, and you don't spend $200, your shipping is $20. You're right back where you started from. So there's a for every product out there, there's a game. There's the theoretical stuff you and I talk about, where we say, okay, if you put 10% more money into the economy, and your population grows 2%, and your economy grows 2%, you and I think will agree that there's 8% inflation someplace. Now, the question is, where? We know it's not an easy 8% on your salary. It was for a while in the 80s when people negotiated that, but not anymore. So maybe at the end of the year you get a 5% raise. So it's going to hurt you as an employee. I have a feeling you don't have an escalator clause in your contract. Now, maybe you do. If you do, you're a smart man. But the thing you and I argue about is, where is the 8% going to pop out? And my story always is where it can. And that really is the answer, right? Where it can. Am I wrong?
Well, in this particular example where we're building a deck, and if there's substantial inflation in materials, I might just say, hey, look, I'll just build it myself because I enjoy building
but
stuff.
But you still got to... How are you going to do it without the 2x4, Mr. Wrench?
What I'll do is I'll save on the labor. I'll just do it myself on the weekends.
Okay.
I'll buy the lumber, right, and then I'll build the deck myself.
We were talking about the lumber and the nails, and now you're going to kick... The guy's son who's the helper off the court. You're gonna do it.
I'm gonna find a way to save money.
Now the question is, we're trying to figure out where's the 8% gonna go, and I'm gonna say, indeterminate. Now if it turns out that your automobiles have just so happens this month cars coming in from some other place have a tariff put on them, I'm gonna say it's into cars. That they're going to be up. They're going to be up more than 8%, which they are, by the way.
Well, if the import car is up 20%, I'm going to look to buy a version that's already here that's been used for about 1,000 miles.
Okay, we're all going to do what we have to do.
Yeah.
You're going to use our intelligence to get around it. But I don't care who the hell you are. If you're buying a car, you could be one of the smartest people. And by the way, I'm pretty good at weaseling around looking for a bargain myself.
Man, I found the last car I bought, I paid cash for it. And in 3 or 4 years, that price of that used car that I bought, it was up like a factor of 4.
See, the thing, you think that's you.
But
it's not.
I was able to buy this car.
It's the inflation level.
And I'm still using it.
I'm going to say this last truck I bought, and I'll be key with everybody. I paid $10,500 for it. I wrote the guy a check. It was fine.
What year did you buy that?
What? Year and a half ago.
It's a year and a half ago.
It's an older truck, but it's...
That's good. What year is it?
It's a 2001, but the 2001 to 2008 were the same vehicle.
Yeah.
And it's a southern truck, so it had no rust.
Yeah.
And I found it, and I had to do some stuff to it. You know what happened?
Did you fly to go pick it up or drive it home?
No, it came from there. But the thing of it is, it had a leather driver's seat that was all messed up. And I just happened to play softball with a guy for 20 years that fixes seats, right?
Yeah.
So he fixed it for me for $300. I don't know where anybody else would have been a grand. But my point is, if I were to sell it today, now whether it's a good buy, bad buy, I can't replace it for less than $12,500.
Exactly, yeah.
So
that's why you keep it.
My point is, what we're arguing about is somebody has caused the price of new cars, the price of repairs, whatever it is, somebody has caused a 20% inflation rate in older, nice trucks in 2 years. It's there.
Well, I don't think
if you walked out to meet him today and said, "Hey, Chief, I love your truck. I need one. My son just wrecked mine." I'd have to say to you, "You got to give me $12,500," and you're going to say, "You only paid $10,500 for it. What's the matter with you?" I don't care. I can't replace it for $10,500.
You just say, "Well, for me to get a similar truck,
it's $12,500.
Without going into debt, I would need that amount."
Yeah. So we can argue about where it is and how much we can save. The fact is, it's there, right? I didn't make it go from $10,500 to $12,500. Somebody else did.
Yeah.
Wait, what do you...
Well, it's the Federal Reserve's creating all this moral hazard.
Yeah.
Right? Yet the government, the Congress, and the president, they don't care about deficits because if nothing else happens and nobody buys a debt, well, the Federal Reserve will, so they continue doing it.
Yeah, they put money. What do you say we go to breaks? We haven't done one yet, even though there's not much going on in the world. But it's funny, you and I get to the same place. We come from different. It's all about the stuff in there. Now does the guy who's buying it from me, or me having to go buy another one, is our salary up $2,000 in the 18 months? I don't think so.
No.
So we know who the losers are, and it's us. we figured out who the enemy is, and it's us. SP Futures down 2, NASDAQ Futures down 8. Be right back.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now, right here, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell, Ricky on the board. SP Futures down $1.75, and the NASDAQ Futures down 6. We ran up again on the close last night. We have mutual fund buying every single night. People are just pouring money into this market, and it's, you know, I don't think it's stopping here yet. I mean, I don't know where, but it's, I don't know that it's certainly not stopping right now. I mean, it doesn't look like it. Which, having said that, don't mean, you know, don't buy in my account, because it's also looking getting pretty darn pricey. The DAX up 103.4, was down yesterday. FTSE up 15.2%. They've been quiet. CAC around up 72.9%. UK home improvement firm Kingfisher surges 18% after lifting output. Kingfisher. Wasn't the guy in Amos and Andy named the Kingfish? You know, you're not supposed to watch that, I know, but over in Asia, Nikkei up 447, another 1%. So wait a minute. They did not trade. That was yesterday. They did not trade today. They have some kind of holiday over there. Maybe Ricky can find out why they have a holiday, but they did not trade today. Hang Seng down 185.7%. 26,159 is their whole number. Shanghai down 6, call that flat. I don't know why Japan was closed. I can't believe they're closed for the Jewish holiday, but maybe they are. I doubt it. A 10-year rate 4.14 unchanged. Oil up 85 cents. Guess what? Right back to 63.13. It goes below 63, goes above 63, comes back to 63. I don't know how long that's going to last, but it's lasted a while. Brent up 75 cents, 67.31. Gold, which goes up every day, is up another 39, but 38.15. God, who would have thunk it? Silver up 31 cents, 44.53. We tried to get even longer in gold yesterday. We didn't get it. Now I'm pissed about that. FX. Dollar almost 118 on the euro. So the dollar's not doing so hot against the euro, but it is a little bit against the pound. The pound has not been as strong. Now, the pound is weakened versus the euro in the last few weeks. It's not just all about us. It can be the dollar versus pound, dollar versus euro, but it's also pound versus euro. I mean, it's another, you know, there's other people in the world but us. Bitcoin up 657. That's 113,000. What do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. The Cubs, I think, have put Cincinnati in the playoffs by losing 4 to them.
Morning, Chief. It's currently 7:42 a.m. here in beautiful Chicago. We're looking at about 64 degrees right now with a high of 77. Cloudy, warm, and humid. A thunderstorm this afternoon. Tonight, partly cloudy with a couple of showers with a low of 65 degrees. Before we go any further, I want to let you know, Chief, that the Japan market is actually closed due to Sports Day. That's a national holiday in Japan. Phoenix, Arizona.
Wait a minute. We're sports. What are we doing at work?
Sports Day. Yeah, honestly. See, I'm not completely sure. I mean, it's just,
well, you're a sport. You played tennis last Saturday.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, but I guess it doesn't warrant the closing of the entire market. You know, that's only in Japan. Phoenix, Arizona, 78 degrees right now with a high of 103. Have plenty of sun tonight. Clear and very warm with a low of 82 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, Emma Kennedy from Montrose, 42 minutes. We're looking at 56 minutes. Indians from Lane Cook, Eisenhower from Wolf, 59 minutes. 29 minutes, then Ryan from 95th. And lastly, Stevenson from 24 to then Ryan, 33 minutes. Let's talk baseball real quick. Today we got White Sox at Yankees at 6:05 p.m., Mets at Cubs at 6:05 p.m., and lastly Dodgers at Diamondbacks at 8:40 p.m. NFL Week 4 starts this Thursday, September 25, with Seahawks at Cardinals, 7:15 p.m., and also we also have Sunday, September 28, Bears at Raiders, 3:25 p.m. Back to you guys.
So, Hal, you know, a guy like you who's going to respond to the increased price of the 2x4 by booting the lowest laborer off the place. There was a sign.
I'm not booting him. I'm just deciding not to hire him.
Well, it's the same thing. The I'll give you two.
I decided to hire myself, Tom, yes, instead of hiring somebody else.
Your highest and best work. There was a sign in this mechanic's place that I went one time, and it was this long time ago. It was something like wage rate or hourly rate, $40 an hour. If you watch, 60. If you help, 80. If you comment, 100.
Comment
100. So in the, I wouldn't want you to be that guy, but I don't know, I was doing something. And I,
well, honestly, Tom, I just don't trust people. I have trust issues. I have trust and authority issues.
See, you know, but if you do trust, walked into this paint store, and I used to remodel houses, so I did all, I was the young hell, or if it was had to be done, I would try and do it, right? Although I actually got pretty good at realizing what I was good at versus what other people were good at, and what I did was I would make sure that the way was clean for the plumber, and then so he could do his stuff without tripping over.
Oh, you do the demolition.
Well, I did everything, and then I'd make sure the plumbing stuff got in. Then I'd put the plasterboard up, and I'd make sure it was done right so the taper came in, because those guys are so fast. Then
Those guys are awesome.
Yeah, I didn't try and do the tile myself, but I made sure it was easiest possible for those guys. So anyway, I walk in this paint store, and it's a Benjamin Moore store, and I'm looking at the paint. I didn't realize, God, he got so many people. He used to come to our seminars and stuff. The guy in there came to my seminar, and he knew me. He goes, Chief, what are you doing in here? I'm like, I'm just looking at the paint, and he goes, why don't we make a deal? He goes, I won't try and manage my money. You don't try and paint. And I'm thinking, there's a lot to be said for that. Yeah. He goes, I won't try and manage my money. You don't try and paint. How about I paint? You manage my money. I'm like, okay. You know, there's something to be said for that.
Well, one thing I don't like doing is I don't like painting.
Because I used to be good at that.
I found out why I don't like humidity and why I'm obsessed with humidity. And I don't like painting because all I did on the Navy ship, outside of standing watch, 5 hours on, 10 hours off, 5 hours on, 10 hours off, while we're underway in the Persian Gulf, where the seawater temperature was 93 degrees and the engine room was 120.
That had to be fun. I think I'll take a bath. Whoops, it's 93 degrees.
Oh, dude, it was horrible in the engine room. 120 degrees in there. We're making steam. It's an old plant, so it's leaking steam. And all I'm doing outside of standing watch is painting.
What were you watching for?
Standing nuclear power plant watch. Oh. Take logs.
I mean, we're watching for, like, enemy planes or anything.
Well, no. We're watching temperature gauges and whatnot, right? And then we're throttling this and throttling that, making sure things don't get too hot, things don't get too cold. We have to do drills. So we're standing watch. Outside of standing watch, I'm painting in the humidity. And those are two things I can't stand because of being in the Persian Gulf with 500 souls on a 500-foot-long ship, and I wouldn't see sun for 30 days straight. Those two things I can't stand.
Oh, I can't imagine. I can't.
Humidity and painting.
Yeah.
Well, Audrey, I will not do it. I will not be out in the humidity.
Well, Audrey's dad I think he was in the Army. Matter of fact, I know he was because he did the uniforms and stuff. Because when I say that, he was a guy who worked on the Trans-Canada roadway, so he knew, you know, a lot about building the roads and stuff. So when he was, I assume he was drafted, and I don't really know, but I think he was drafted. They put him on like a construction group where he was in the Pacific, but he bivouacked next to the runway.
Aren't the drafted guys usually the ones that go to the front line and the guys that volunteer, the ones that get kinds of jobs?
Well, they used to be, remember the movie with John Wayne in it? Was the Seabees, the construction battalions? Yeah. Call them the Seabees, but those guys were recruited. But anyway, they found out that he had this skill. So if they're on, he was on Okinawa, but he was next to the runway. It was his bivouac, and if a Japanese guy came by and dropped a bomb on a runway, he and his other guys scurried out and fixed the hole. You know, so that's what they did. So
in the Navy, he would have been called a runway mate.
Okay. Well, they decided that the Japanese were going to attack the Aleutians, right? So they brought him and one of his battalion. They're going to bring them up to the Aleutians to build a runway, or to maintain one that was half-assed there already. So they go up. I think they went up on a submarine or something, and they're supposed to drop them off in, somehow or another, in like, you know, 6 feet of water or something, or they're supposed to have the landing craft. Well, somehow something didn't work out, and all these guys got dunked in like 10 feet of water, and most of them made it to shore. I think all of them made it to shore, but now they've got they're freezing, right? And they go, well, there might be a Japanese submarine out there, you can't start a fire. So evidently that whole night, a couple of guys died, a bunch of other people got, you know, pretty severe. What happens when you get cold? It's a disease. What do they call that? When you get cold, too cold. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
So
frostbite?
Well, what's the thing when your whole body temperature goes down?
Hypothermia.
Yeah, hypothermia. And the guy lived to be 96, and one thing he didn't want to be is cold, ever.
Yeah. Well, those guys are tough.
Yeah.
Those. He's World War II, right?
Oh, yeah. And he was...
World War II guys are just tough.
So I said to him, I go, Elmer, when were you most afraid? And he goes, well, the bombs were coming down a bunch of places, and we're running out fixing the runway, and they're still bombing a place. I mean, he had a gun, but they never sent him out to go fight in the jungle.
Yeah, a gun doesn't really protect you against a bomb.
No.
Yeah.
So he goes, "We, you know, plus... if somebody missed the runway, they could have landed on us. We were, like, right next to it." But then he said, we had problems in the Aleutians. He said, the most afraid I was coming home. He goes, I was in this Liberty ship. How the thing was helping me held together, I have no idea. And we're in this storm, and we're down in steerage, you know, like you were. And he goes, the screw keeps coming out of the water. Then it would go back in. And he goes, I don't know if that thing's going to fly off. He goes, and you can see the water coming in, and the bilge pumps are going. He goes, I went through all this crap to croak on this funky old livery ship. Life isn't fair.
The bombs were better than the ship.
Oh, yeah, but finally, you know, it cleared up a little bit, and somehow they made it back to Hawaii. I don't know how he got back from Hawaii, but I don't think it was a Liberty ship. But
oh, man, that ship, man, we were on, my buddies and I, we hit 30-foot swells going from Seattle to Hawaii. And it was a river of puke in there, seriously.
Well, how bad were the waves had to be coming off? The waves had to be coming across the front.
Oh, yeah, and the screw would come out of the water. You know, you're going over these swells. You're trying to ride them,
doesn't
right?
Doesn't that mess with the screw and the grease packing and everything?
Well, no, there's a water seal. I think it's been a long time since
I studied. Can't be good for the thing. And then slow back down again and back up. It can't be.
Oh, I think it's all right because it's really not spinning like the main engine shaft of like a sports car. It's not spinning that fast.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but the screw would come out of the water and we'd slam into the next wave and people were, you know, bunks were being flying everywhere and people were puking. And I was in training division because I was in the nuclear program. I was in training division. I just showed up. And everybody else in training division was sick. So I was like, well, why would I? That's like taking a smoke break, right? All these smokers get smoke breaks. I'm going to go take a smoke break even though I don't smoke.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Why not?
All these guys in T-Dub are puking. I'm going to tell everybody I'm puking. So I was in my pit listening to Metallica.
God.
Anytime Chief would walk through, I'd go, oh.
Did you ever get on one of the battleships? I mean, I'm sort of the other. Did you ever get on one of the battleships?
It was a small. It was
when
a small
I toured in New Jersey, and you got this huge bow, right? And you got the guns.
Well, those
up
battleships are pretty heavy. Our cruiser was thrown around like a rag doll.
Well, but the thing of it is, that was they got this big metal thing between the bow and the first turret. Yeah. You figure, what the hell's that? That was for when water came over the bow, it would hit that thing and it would send it off the sides. It almost looked like a cow catcher on those old locomotives.
Oh, wow.
And it would send the water off to the sides because you didn't want to hit in the turret, the extent you could.
Well,
but the
that was a coal powered ship, right?
No, they were all oil.
It was a steamer.
They were oil.
It was a diesel powered.
No, I think they were. I think they made steam.
Yeah, I mean, but it was oil. It was oil. Yeah. So yeah, it had a smokestack. So
yeah, they had a stack.
Yeah, we didn't have a smokestack. Our nuclear power plant would run flooded or not. So,
So what? We've got 8 minutes here, but we've got markets doing this. We have a government that's pushing. Either they want to or they don't want to. They're heading toward this, almost like a plutocracy. It isn't fascism. It's a plutocracy, which is essentially government by the wealthy.
Yeah.
And regardless of you wanting this to happen economically, Carl wanting this to happen economically, none of the stuff we talk about, I mean, he can talk, and by the way, I agree with him 100% that this administration, the last one jaw-jagged a little bit about it, but that was about it, and his did nothing before it regarding the big hole, and the big hole is in this medical stuff. Now, yesterday, again, we let Pfizer, which in my mind is way too big, way too powerful, just pay $7 billion, of which they have because they charge way too much for stuff, whether it's on patent or after patent or whatever they do. I'm sure that Pfizer has a serious research department and everything, but they also have a bunch of people that all they do is look around for other people that actually have some good R&D and got a good product with the intention of buying them and making them. And I tell you what, I think that has to stop. Now, yeah. Now, who the hell is going to listen to me? I mean, everybody on the show has kind of their quiet rave, right? I mean, you have yours about the way the economy runs, and by the way, I agree with you, although I never can in the air. Carl's the same way. These people need to be taken down in the medical area because, A, we can't afford it, whether it's
crooked
or not.
I think we just take away their privileges. Okay, right? On college campuses, you hear about white privilege all the time. Well, where do those privileges come from? Come from government either restricting the market.
I understand. But tie it all
with rules and restrictions or licenses. Let's just get rid of all that stuff.
Tie it all together.
Yeah.
And if you tie it all together, what you said, pardon me for saying this, isn't worth the breath you expelled. Because the people who are tying the place together, that are running everything, are the people that are doing it. So the idea that...
And I've long said, these Democrats and Republicans, they pretend to be at each other's throats.
No, they pretend
to be... They use the media to divide their voters, right? They use the media to divide their voters.
This is the first time, though, I've ever seen people admit it, though. I mean, that's kind of the biggest argument I have with my guests. It's been going along. You can't just blame Trump because Biden... And I know that, but it's the first time now we've gotten to the point where they just admit it and say, try and do something about it.
Yeah.
It's reached the... You know, it's one thing for...
Well, I don't think anything's going to happen. I think what's going to happen is markets, people, entrepreneurs... America is really unique because we have this culture of risk-taking. And in other countries, they don't have it. In America, you have these risk-takers. And they're going to... If they see an above-normal margin, they're going to attack it.
How are you going to attack a patented too high margin from Pfizer? Yeah. Good luck with that, my friend.
Yeah, I know that's tough, right? That is really tough because not only do you have that, you also have the third party payer system.
But those people are making so much dough. I mean, I think that we're all in agreement that if it's a smaller sort of thing, one of my clients, I don't know, I don't think I didn't die. He was a guy that would. Look at all the specs. Talk about how American this is. He would look at all the specs of like a big, you know, renovation of, say, McCormick Place or you name it, whatever it happens to be. If they're doing your whatever town you live in or the university you work at, if they're gonna redo their sports facility or something, whatever they're gonna do, they're gonna come out with all these plans, right? And he's gonna read all the electrical plans. He's not going to go out for bid on them. He's not big enough, okay? But he's going to read all the plans, and he's going to say, well, you know, HAL Engineering put together this thing, and as usual, HAL Engineering did a nice job. They need this cable. They need this transformer and all stuff. But HAL's too damn busy, and he's way too full of himself, which wouldn't be you, by the way. He says we need 300 of these fasteners. Well, I just went over the whole list here. Looks to me like we need 3,000 or something along those lines. And he would go through every one of these, the electrical drawings of all these places. And instead of putting in a bid for that, he would look at the amount of the 100 or 200 or 300 different kind of fasteners that you would need for all the electrical equipment and say, they need way more of this one, way more of that one. This one maybe is okay. And the day the thing starts, he shows up with a truck, with all his stuff on the truck. And he says, guys, you're going to be needing this. Trust me. I'll just come by once a week, and you can buy them from me at a decent price.
Yeah.
And that was his business, was selling stuff on site to people who sort of needed it. It was almost like pulling into the backyard of a hospital and saying, you idiots, you need more bandages, and you need more thread or sutures, and I'll have my little truck out here, and if you need it, come get it. Same sort of thing, right? The guy made a handsome living doing that. Now, that's so American, isn't it? I mean,
oh yeah. Well, the food trucks outside of MIT and Volpe, when I was there for the summer back in 2003, you walk out and there's a food truck. There's a lot of food trucks there, and they sold this one food truck sold really good Thai food. I would buy a box of Thai food. I would eat half of it for lunch, and I'd walk home with it, and I would have my beer on the way home at some Irish pub.
There you go.
And at night, I would heat it up, and I'd eat the rest of it. And it's the same kind of thing, right?
Why didn't I go to a place?
Americans are really, really good at finding these opportunities, and it just doesn't happen. Well,
but only to a point. You can't channel. You can't challenge at this point, Pfizer. You can't challenge.
Well, you know, I think RFK Jr. is trying to, but he's discovering how difficult that is. I think if RFK Jr. had his way, he would do what we're saying right here. I think he would.
It starts with antitrust laws. It starts with patent laws. It starts with some, and I don't know where you find this. I'm not somewhere along the line. If you and I go back to the polio thing, because when I was a kid, I was too young. Parents were you know paranoid about polio. I mean, we're not talking about your kid dying. We're talking about being an iron lung for 50 years. I mean, it's
yeah.
I mean, I can't think of anything worse. But the you know what is something like that worth? I mean, my dad, I'm thinking, was making as a policeman $2,500 a year, maybe.
Didn't the guy that invented the polio vaccine give it away for free?
He said something about it. He couldn't possibly patent something like that.
Yeah, can you imagine Pfizer doing that?
Yeah, no. And so I don't know if he gave it away for free, but he didn't patent it. But mm-hmm. I mean, how much?
He didn't establish a monopoly, right? He didn't establish a monopoly and sell it at monopoly prices.
What would out of my $2,500 a year my dad was making as a policeman, which I think he was making, he wasn't even that much. What would he have paid for a polio shot for me and my brother? I bet he would have paid a year's salary.
Yeah.
Now does that make it fair? I mean, I don't know. What's fair? I mean, we're seeing some of these at some point, and I don't know. You and I are never going to be in Congress because if one of these buffoons comes in there talking about drug prices, I think that I just might let it slip, and I know you would because you have less filter between brain and mouth than me. You would say, I mean, I have very little one, so when it comes to this kind of stuff, and I think you might even have less. Somewhere along the line, you're going to say, "Hey, Chairman of Pfizer, you just hit these guys up for $50,000 for this chemo. By the way, what does it cost you?"
Yeah.
You never hear that question. I guarantee he's going to back into something. Do you have any idea what the research and this and that?
Let me give an audience a clue here. The research and development argument is a joke because research and development happens in every industry.
Yeah.
It wouldn't stop if we got rid of the patent process. But it just wouldn't stop.
Hell, it's their story and they're sticking to it.
It would happen.
Yeah.
Because there are scientists out there who out of their goodness of their heart and their passion for what they do, they want to find the cure for some disease. So the research and development is going to happen whether there's a patent or not. The patent just grants this company a monopoly.
And it doesn't give them an
option. We all hate monopolies unless they're a big pharma company for some reason.
And if you and I, matter of fact, next week, let's kick this around. Let's take this apart. Carl have done it a couple times, but who gets the patent? I mean, I don't know if you weren't a guest today when Katie was on. Let's say you and I saw this thing last night about sickle cell. So let's say you and I pony up some scratch-o and we find out there's a researcher and, you know, God knows where. So let's say it's, you know, Vanderbilt. We'll pick a spot that looks like he's got something cooking on sickle cell or whatever it is, any kind of an orphan disease or sickle cell or anything. You and I say, all right, you know what? This guy's close. I hate the fact that people get this disease. It's awful. You know, the fact that it affects mostly black people, I don't care. The fact is it's an awful disease. You and I send those guys $1 million. Okay, so then they get $1 million from the government because the guy's close. And people like Katie work there for, you know, minimum wage when they should be working a lot more. And all of a sudden, bingo. This guy's got a shot that knocks out sickle cell anemia, but you got to take it once every 6 months. And all of a sudden, Pfizer buys the thing. Now, wait a minute. Who are they buying it from? Are they buying it from Vanderbilt? All they did was charge a overhead on the money you and I gave them. They didn't pay Katie squat, and in her contract, they said that any part of it she doesn't get. The doctor, does he get anything? I don't know. Now, does Vanderbilt, what's his deal with them? Is he a research guy from Vanderbilt? And all of a sudden, Pfizer, somebody sweeps in. Who's this is real simple. Let's do this next week. Who the hell's patent is it?
Yeah.
I guess it's theirs.
Well, if Pfizer buys the IP, if they buy the IP, they can patent it.
But who do they buy it from? Why don't you and I get a piece? We funded the damn thing.
Yeah.
Who gets it? Now all of a sudden, we find
that
somebody.
That just goes to show you that the research and development is going on.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going on because there are people who are passionate about saving other people's lives.
So if we find research
and development's going to go on whether it's patented or not.
So if we find somebody who can make the stuff for $20 a shot, why when somebody sticks it in somebody's ass is it $500 a shot? Who's that? How do they get to do that? Well, we did this. We're funding new research. Bull crap, right?
Well, you know, if you really think about this whole business model, like Ozempic, and those type of drugs, the problem with Ozempic is you have to stay on it to keep the weight off.
Plus, it makes you, I know two guys,
and that's
on it.
The kind of drug that these companies are looking for.
It makes you
something
so uncomfortable.
That you have to take every day.
You know anybody who's on it? You know anybody who's on it?
I don't know anybody's on it, but
I know two people on it. They feel like crap. Dry heaves, driving. No wonder they're losing weight, for God's sake.
Yeah.
You can do the same thing with castor oil.
But if they go off that drug, I've heard that they gain the weight back
More. Yeah. S&P Futures down 1, NASDAQ Futures up 2. Hell, thank you very much. Good stuff. What are you doing this weekend?
Just working on a class. I'm going to a high school on Thursday to visit with high school students down in Fayetteville.
Are you guys on break, or what do you do? You're...
No, I work remotely.
Okay.
And all my classes are online, so I'm going to drive down to Fayetteville to do a little recruiting.
How do they know you're even alive? How do they know it's not a film of you from 5 years ago?
I'm an AI. You didn't know that?
Oh, God. You can very well. I can see you being an AI. We could do. Got to imagine if we did an AI with Carl.
I got the name right, HAL 9000.
Yeah. Imagine if we did AI with Carl. Say, Carl, you know, there's no Carl anymore. This is all the stuff he's ever said. We just put it all together through AI. God. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com.